forever. Dog.
Comic books, comic time. Writers and artists are on the line. They make a splash as a comic's read and take us on a trip behind the spread. Watch out for comic book commentary. Spinning a winning inside fix, how they got a hot idea. Narrative, character, visual tricks, and bam, onomatopoeia. Uh-huh. It's comic book commentary.
Hey, what's up? I'm Jackson Lansing.
And I'm Colin Kelly.
And we are together, Jackson Lansing.
And Colin Kelly.
And we are the writers and ostensibly the showrunners on Star Trek Year 5, the new series from IDW, which tells the final season of Star Trek, the original series.
That's correct. Today on Comic Book Commentary.
Comic Book Commentary.
We're going to be going over issues 1 and 2, which basically combine to tell the first episode of this season. IDW has been doing something really innovative and interesting with this entire run of comics. The plan is for Jack and I essentially to start things off, but then we tag the story off to a series of writers that function as a writer's room. And every two issues of the book are going to combine to tell one episode of the season.
So by the end of the planned 24 issues, you'll have 12 episodes of Star Trek Year 5. And those are going to be written about half of those will be written by Colin and myself. The other half will be written by a combination of Brandon Easton, Jody Hauser, and Jim McCann.
Oh, yeah.
All of whom are amazing and all of whom will be coming along with their own artists, which have not yet been announced yet. But we have been working and had the extreme pleasure of working with Stephen Thompson, who kills it from moment one on this book.
Absolutely. Charlie Kirkoff is our colorist, who absolutely brings the thunder and makes Steven's work come to life.
And all of it is only made possible by Neil Uyatake, who is putting together our lettering and making our words actually make sense on the page. So we're going to, as per usual on this podcast, we're just going to be going through issue by issue or page by page. But in the case of this one, which I guess is unique, we're going to actually be handling two full issues. So we're going to kind of move at a clip so that we don't keep you here forever and ever.
That being said, I do want to start with an immediate tangent.
We're not going to take any time at all, except for this half hour we're going to do to just like talk about Star Trek.
We are going to save you all from us gushing about how much we love Star Trek. I think you guys can probably, if you know about us at all, you know what an absolute dream this project was for us. Obviously, Trek is deep in our DNA. But what you might not know is that it's deep in Steven's DNA. We have never before experienced something like this. When we turned in our first draft of the first issue, the notes we got back from Steven were things along the lines of, well, actually, I believe that you mean the Mark III phaser. And such things as, well, the conference room on that level of the Trek of the bridge actually doesn't have view windows.
Yeah, hey, dummy, the view screen isn't a window. You've been watching the J.J. Abrams movies too much. He was deeply already ready to hit Star Trek where it lived and to do so with attention to detail and attention to what really would have operated on the original series. And since a big part of the point of this book is to tell the original series, to really go after William Shatner's version of Captain Kirk, Leonard Nimoy's version of Mr. Spock, and so on, that we wanted to make sure that wherever possible, we were sticking to the details of the series and calling back to our favorite moments from the series as we told the arcs forward. None of that is really workable or feasible without actually telling these character stories. And the unique opportunity that I think we have in this book, to go off on my own tangent for a second, is that we get an opportunity to take these characters who normally were essentially put episode to episode through the ringer and came out the other side a little bit changed. And then generally those changes weren't reflected in the next episode, because it was a syndicated television show in the late 1960s. Now what we get to do is actually take these characters and say, here's what they're going through in a straight line, in a real arc. Like, here's how they're going from A to B. So we, before we even sat down, figured out where our characters were starting in issue one, or rather episode one in issues 1 and 2, and where they were going to end up in episode 12 or issues 23 and 24.
And more specifically, after issue 24, which is the motion picture. Like, we have an endpoint. We know where these characters are going to need to end up. The big question we got to answer is, how do they get there?
Yeah, by the end of this, we're going to actually take you to the season finale of Star Trek, the original series, which is, or series finale of Star Trek, the original series, which is pretty exciting.
It's very exciting. It's a little tragic, but let's not make our listeners cry yet. Not when we can make them cry at the bottom of this page.
So, welcome to Star Trek Year 5. On page one, we start with a little trick that we pull off in the comics biz sometimes. It's a pre-lap to a future event. We start in media res right away, and we are going to show you where this book is going. Now, we're not going to tell you where this is going to drop this moment. It might seem like this might come at the end of the issue. It doesn't. It might seem like it's going to come at the end of the episode. It doesn't. So where does this moment take place? What's going on in this moment? Who is that that's holding a gun to the back of James T. Kirk's head as he seemingly flies the Enterprise into its certain doom? All of those are questions we want you to be asking.
All alone on that bridge. These are riddles that will be unraveled as the story progresses. But for right now, it was kind of our introduction to let you know that we see these stakes as being the highest possible. So welcome to the journey.
We did a little thing here that I'm proud of, so I'll call it out, where we have Kirk incorporate that phrase that he says at the beginning of every episode of Star Trek. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise, her five-year mission to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, and to boldly go where no man has gone. And then when we flip the page and go back in time to before, we end that phrase with before, and it turns into a caption, and boom, we're right back into Star Trek as we know it. So if you open this first page and you're like, wait, where's Sulu? Where's Chekhov? Where's Spock? Why is the Enterprise crashing? Who's got that gun to Kirk's, you know, head? All of those are questions we're going to answer, but we wanted to immediately drop you back into the Star Trek that you know and love and really pick up from there in the middle of a mission.
And if this double page spread doesn't just smack you in the face, I don't know what kind of Trek fan you are. Like, Stevens, the way he's rendered the Enterprise is so slick and so cool, but absolutely classic. And then we have this amazing, huge interstellar anomaly, the hypernova.
A hypergiant.
Apologies.
That's cool. It will become a hypernova if the Enterprise doesn't do anything about it.
Oh my goodness. Spoiler alert. ironically, actually, this is one of the only notes that we got from CBS. When working with licensors, you never quite know how they're going to act. And the Trek folks have been nothing but awesome. Their notes to us are things like, well, we believe that the science behind that hypergiant might be the gravitational waves might be affected. And it was like, oh my goodness.
Initially, this was a neutron star collision. And they basically questioned whether or not that was even feasible for the Enterprise to survive. And ultimately, it made a lot more sense to move in this direction. And it actually ended up giving us a really great story tool that we pay off over the course of the issue. And we'll talk about that here in a second. Because the mission is, the Enterprise is here to take the excess energy from this hypergiant, because hypergiant stars, when they explode, are catastrophic, actually. They will send out these massive particle jets, these streams. And if those jets or streams hit any kind of life, especially if they were, say, to hit a planet, they will extinguish all life on that planet immediately. In fact, we have an extinction event in our Earth's history, the Silurian event, which we hypothesized to be because we got hit by a jet stream from a hypernova. So we thought, it's amazing because anything that comes out of this could be a catastrophic, not just for the planets in the general system that this hypernova is in, but in fact for, systems for light years and light years
the
and light years apart.
The entire arm of the galaxy could be under threat, which is not something that the Federation is going to let occur. So the Enterprise has basically towed a device out here that is going to help funnel that extra energy out.
And here comes, if we turn that page to page four, here comes Spock to explain all of that to us.
He's going to Spock-splain it to us.
Writing Spock-splanation is super, super fun. You have to be a little bit wary that you're not using too many words, because actually Nimoy's version of Spock isn't actually as verbose as you might recall. But here it really felt like a chance to just dig right in and get a little verbose with it and let him explain the full scientific stakes of what's going on. And that's, again, I think a thing that you get to do when you're dealing with the 1960s version of Star Trek. Mm-hmm. Embrace science. Embrace interesting science fiction concepts. Embrace a little bit of explanation to the audience about how this stuff works, and then create dramatic stakes behind it.
Well, and I like to imagine that, like, you know, Nimoy walked onto set this day and there was a whole scene written and he was like, well, actually, I think this is my scene. Right? And they're like, you know what, Leonard, sure, this is your scene. The clash of egos is something that we absolutely love bringing to life here.
And as we get to the, we get to the end of his explanation, this is the first of our little like plants in terms of nods to the previous series. Kirk essentially goes to Spock and is like, now that you've established this is the most dangerous mission that we've ever attempted, do you have any problem with doing it? Do you have any reservations? And Spock looks down and says, none whatsoever. This is a Starfleet vessel. Risk is our business. And risk is our business is actually, he is at that point re-quoting Kirk back to himself. So if you've never seen Star Trek, the original series, that's just a cool line where Spock is saying a thing that makes sense. He's like, no, I believe in us. Let's go. But if you're a Star Trek fan, you'll recognize that line from Return to Yesterday, in which case Kirk actually delivers that line in order to push the crew towards attempting a really dangerous mission that will have huge consequences, actually specifically for Spock.
And I'm just going to go ahead and read this because it's a fun one. Chekhov, after his giant kind of after Spock's big long speech, Chekhov kind of rolls his eyes in a perfect little comedic beat and says, that was a very, very long walk down a very short pier.
You're gonna be getting a lot of that from Colin. Fun behind the scenes fact. I have been running a Star Trek role playing game for a very, very long time. It's one of the ways that it really got into our blood. We were both raised on Star Trek, but I've been exploring it in an RPG space for a long time. And Colin actually played Chekhov for a while in that game.
It's true.
As an old man admiral. So. Here you go.
I'm going to deploy, and next I'm going to do my Scotty Doonit. No.
So risk is our business. Let's go forward. We turn the page and we actually get the mission. We see, this beautiful image. I think he just captures James Doohan so perfectly here, Stephen does, that awe on Scotty's face. We talk about these arcs that we want to take the characters on. Mm-hmm. And Scotty's arc is really built, at least in part, on the idea that he is, they've been on this old starship. At this point now, this is a 5-year-old starship. Mm-hmm. For quite some time. And here comes this piece of, high-tech Enterprise equipment that's coming along and kind of making them look like an old junker. And if you know anything about Scotty, the last thing that he wants is for the Enterprise to feel anything like a junker or a garbage scow. So this is, a really great opportunity for him to look out at the stars and be like, man, there's so much more for me out there when they get back home. And we also get our first captain's log.
We get our first captain's log as we're kind of going through all of this. The thing that we love about Kirk and the thing that a lot of us forget, especially, younger Trek fans might forget, you think, oh, well, Kirk is the campy captain. But in reality...
Or the irresponsible captain, or the reckless captain.
The sex
if you came
monger.
Up on the 09, yep, he's the guy who's sleeping from port to port.
But Kirk in reality was much more of a philosopher traveler. We bang the Odyssey drum quite a lot in our text, and that's because we see a parallel between him and Odysseus in a lot of ways. And it's also in his pensive intelligence, right? This Kirk he's not a dummy. He thinks about everything and he's steeped in history, in the classics, and he knows where he sits. And that's kind of what he's ruminating on as we punch in and we find him and Bones meeting together for a drink as he celebrates his air quotes, his great news.
Kirk has been promoted. And this is one of those places where we know that this has to happen, right? The motion picture establishes that Kirk becomes an admiral and isn't terribly happy in that role. And so what we wanted to do was show him get that position, have some trepidation about it, and show how he eventually accepts that position and why. There's something kind of tragic about that. There's certain elements of Star Trek Year 5 that end up then presenting themselves in their own way as a tragedy. Obviously, none of these characters are going to die. We can't kill them. But there's a really amazing opportunity to establish a more personal element of tragedy, that the great journey is coming to an end. And we wanted to look at that in the face, not at the end of the season, but at the very end of the series, but at the very, very beginning of it, and let that steep the whole tone of the show. Also, side note, no one is more fun to write than DeForest Kelly's Bones. He is just a blast to write. He is so much fun. He is so uniquely human. He bounces off of Kirk so beautifully, easy voice to get, and a really a lovely character to write. He feels like your friend the minute you start writing him. And then we get to this nine paneler.
Ugh, I'm in awe. Like this, I mean, it's like I'm not even looking at the words. It's just like Stephen's art is so fucking beautiful. There's so much raw storytelling. And I think you pointed out, he's able to capture the character, but not. He's not relying on likenesses.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is James T. Kirk. Yes, it's also obviously Bill Shatner, but everything about this is so vibrant and real, and I just cannot get over it. It's so good.
I always look to that fourth panel, and it's like that particular way that the arms sort of stretch out, and the you know, he has sort of a plaintive look on his face. Like, that's the kind of acting that Shatner gave you specifically. Like, it's mm-hmm. very expressive and human and inviting. And it's the kind of thing that's very easy to ignore. And it's not like we called that out. He brought that to the page. So, you know, nine panel can be really restricting. But in this particular case, I think he just did a great job and ultimately brought us down to our first big character step. Our first time where we're kind of, mm-hmm. I think, putting our you put your flag down, you know, on the moon, and you're like, this is our starting point. And our starting point here is Kirk has been promoted, and there's not a day that goes by that he doesn't say it. Captain James T. Kirk of the USS Enterprise. I just don't know who I am if I'm not. Who Captain Kirk is if he is not the commander of the Enterprise is going to be something we're interrogating throughout this series, but it's also specifically something that we're interrogating in this episode.
Mm-hmm.
In this first two issues, we wanted to focus our lens on Kirk and understand what makes him different than any other captain. What makes him different than Picard or Sisko or Janeway or the 09 Kirk or Lorca or like what makes him fundamentally Kirk? What makes him the greatest captain? And that's, I think, something we're going to essay as we get into the actual conflict.
Mm-hmm. Turning the page, we kind of get this amazingly fun scene between Scotty and Spock as they kind of have a tete-a-tete back and forth. And essentially, Scotty is irritated. He needs help down in engineering, and Spock has just kind of been delegating it. And the point here is something that we really want to explore is the idea that Spock has been assuming that everyone else on the Enterprise here is functioning as a well-oiled machine because he himself is a well-oiled machine. But the reality is you can't delegate everything. Like, he is essentially being told off here, like, no, you can't just tell people what to do. You are still a vital part of this. You are, I mean, for lack of a better word, humanity is important to the function of this ship. You can't step away. We need you, Spock, not an Excel spreadsheet.
Especially given that we're getting to the end of their mission, and I think Scotty rightly sort of looks forward into Spock's future and is like, well, if you're ever going to be a starship captain, which, I mean, we again know, you know, from the history of Star Trek,
right,
he will not become a Starfleet captain. That's not a job he's going to take on. But at this point, that is the next step in his assumed path. He's been the first officer on the Enterprise for 5 years. Mm-hmm. He would be the first Vulcan captain in Starfleet. That makes total sense. And so Spock himself is even holding himself to that standard right now. He doesn't know what's coming next. And he also doesn't know that Kirk has been promoted. So there's some really interesting, exciting moves that start here in terms of planting those flags.
Yep.
This is Spock being told, you maybe have to start dealing with things a little bit more head on if you want to be a captain. And Spock is thinking, okay, maybe I do.
Meanwhile, Kirk comes onto the bridge.
Which we are now 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. We're 10 pages in, meaning we are halfway through the first issue and a quarter of the way through our first episode. And mm-hmm. that's when our plot kicks in.
Yep, plot's kicking in. There is a distress signal coming from a nearby planet. It's scrambled a little bit, but Uhura informs them it is definitely Tholian.
It's from the planet Lloyd Zeta 9, which, sort of personal fact, my stepfather, Don Lloyd, is a he's an astrophysicist, and I was raised around a lot of astrophysics and a lot of astrophysicists. But Don's work, primarily when he was doing his thesis work, was all built on neutron stars. So a big part of what we wanted to do here, that's why we pitched the neutron star collision for that first part. When we moved the neutron star out and we replaced it with the hypergiant, we just went ahead and kept the name of the star system as a tribute to him. Well, there's a few more tributes to people in our lives throughout the issue, and we'll try to let you know when those show up.
Mm-hmm. High five, Don.
But as Colin pointed out, this is our first indication of what we're going to be dealing with here from a Star Trek mythology perspective, which is the Tholians are showing up.
Mm-hmm.
And let's talk about the Tholians for a second.
Sure. The Tholians.
Why pick the Tholians?
Why pick the Tholians? Yeah, absolutely. So from our perspective, and not even perspective, from a fact of Trek, the Tholians are one of the few and least essayed alien species ever touched in the Trek mythos. We have heard about them. We have seen them. We have seen their ships, and we've seen them once in TOS, which is a Tholian web.
And once in Enterprise.
Where they are in the Mirror Universe. But they are ostensibly one of the largest, forces in the Alpha Quadrant.
If you look at any of the Star Trek maps, the Tholians have more space to their name than the Federation, than the Klingons, than any of these other larger species.
Mm-hmm.
And yet we know almost nothing about them. So we really thought this was a great opportunity to, like, they were introduced in TOS. Let's go ahead and really essay them in TOS. Let's use the toys that are on the table. And it also, a couple of other sort of reasons for that, you're doing comic books, so all of a sudden budget allows you to do a lot more incredible stuff with the Tholians.
Because these are, 9 foot tall crystal spiders, and which is tough to do on a 1968 budget.
And also it gives you a great opportunity to tell stories about encountering the most alien of species.
Exactly. That's the key.
And since what we wanted to do here was really, we'll get into this soon as we see more of why we're using the Tholians, but we really wanted to make this story, like any good Star Trek story, about our world and about what we are going through. But not by being like, okay, we're going to introduce a Donald Trump analog. That's not the point. The point is rather to look at the ways that we are handling fear of the other and fear of that which doesn't feel like us or look like us or have the same background as us. And let's find a way to essay that in a new way using the Tholians. And so that's going to be an effort, to sort of give away the ghost a little bit. That's going to be an effort all the way up until issue 24.
And I think that's not to tangent again, but just a quick pivot. Like, Trek is known for a lot of things, but the thing about the original series is, like, it's not just that Kirk himself was a poet, it's that the show itself was tackling the untouchable issues of the day. We might look at back now and say, oh, how cute, they're tackling, like, racism by making the aliens of different colors, but that's big effing deal! In the time period when it was dropping, and that is the energy. And to everyone's credit on board the editorial and licensing side, when we said, look, we want this series to be as transgressive and exploratory.
Yeah.
As the original series, everyone was absolutely on board. So please watch us as we deploy. We're attempting to do the same magic trick that Gene Kuhn and Roddenberry and all these titans of the industry pulled off all those years ago, which is feed you bubblegum pop science fiction that is going to hit you right in the heart and the mind as you think about how this Adventures of Space Cowboys essentially relates back to your day-to-day life.
And I think that's an interesting point, which is that, you use the word like bubblegum pop. Like, I think a lot of people immediately upon hearing that will be like, well, that's not what Star Trek is. Like,
right.
Star Trek is really serious contemplative science fiction, especially TOS. But ultimately, the show's best moments were when it was able to take some of that adventurous spirit, some of that military sci-fi spirit, and marry it with that contemplative feeling. If it was always contemplation and people talking in rooms, the show would never have functioned. It needed episodes like Arena in order to function.
Exactly.
And so I think what we're trying to do is always marry a little bit of those two. Speaking of which,
We get to our first vista of a Tholian world. It's kind of these crags of, it's these giant red crystal pyramids and mighty obelisks, except something terrible has happened. A cataclysm that has ruined the landscape, absolutely shattered every single Tholian.
It's almost like someone has attacked this place.
Almost.
And we get our first sort of clues about this. We set up this thing called the harmonic resonator, which is essentially allowing them to locate Tholians, trying to find any kind of survivors. Rather than approaching the Tholians as enemies, the Federation is showing up here, and Kirk is just trying to make sure that they're all right. Unfortunately, it would really appear that they are too late. Yeah. And we get a nice little to our point of contemplative science fiction. We get a little bit more science in here. They investigate the bodies, and they realize that these Tholians seem to have been frozen down to absolute zero, and that has shattered them. That essentially the Tholians run so hot, and that is something that we know from Star Trek canon, that they run very, very hot in terms of their internal body temperature, that seemingly by dialing down that body temperature, they've actually created a weapon that's been able to destroy Tholians. But who could possibly do this? How could that be? And before we're able to really solve that answer, Kirk is starting to get a theory. He has this bit about how everybody in the Iliad, they were all fighting each other, but they were all Greek. So he's starting to wonder, like, okay, maybe only Tholians would know Tholian weakness when...
Mm-hmm. Oh, my God! What's that coming out of the shadows?
Attacked by Tholians.
The last Tholian alive on this place comes charging out of the shadows, this, you know, hulking monster. The red shirts are firing their phasers, but my God, the phasers, they do nothing! He's charging down on bones! And meanwhile, Kirk has raced over, like, what is... Kirk's one of his best things is his tactical mind, and he realizes in that split second, well, if phasers aren't working, I need to concoct some kind of weapon. Thank God, because of his experience in Arena, he kind of is already starting to think about how to put the pieces together. He's getting to work on that harmonic resonator, trying to, you know, customize it and fit the firing mechanism from his laser rifle or phaser rifle in there, but he still needs more time. Spock, do something!
And I mean, I think it's an exciting opportunity for Spock to utilize the lesson that he's been taught a few pages earlier, which is that he needs to maybe face some problems head on. And so we get this great moment where Spock utilizes that famous Vulcan strength to punch that Tholian right in the chest, crack it up, create enough of a weakness point that Kirk can fire his new harmonic resonator phaser, whaboom, and take out this Tholian. I also, special shout out here, both to Charlie, who worked really hard to find the sort of color that was going to function properly for the Tholians. Mm-hmm. This is a very hard color job, creating something that feels like it's like hot from the inside, but still manages to have shadow and light. But also, I love the way that the Tholian language is represented. Neil did a really wonderful job of creating something that felt like we would have no idea how to understand it, because this is another aspect of Tholians that we're going to be getting into over the course of the series. They can understand us and speak to us. We cannot understand them or speak to them without their translators. Mm-hmm. Traditionally, the Tholians are basically they are so far away from what we understand to be normal humans that our translators don't work on them. It's only with Tholian translators that we're able to really speak to them. And that separation, that misunderstanding, is going to be a really core part of our series.
Mm-hmm. Luckily, you know, they're able to take down this massive Tholian, though perhaps, you know, obviously it's never a celebration when there's a loss of life. But unfortunately, bloop, they get an alarm. The Tholians, or a group of Tholians, a starship, has dropped in from warp above the planet. And Scotty's basically like, Captain, you know, you got to get back up here.
I love the... this bit where Spock reveals his hand is broken, really just sort of nonchalantly. Like, he's punched the Tholian so hard that his hand is broken. I just think is wonderful. And also, this is a totally new Tholian ship design, courtesy of Stephen Thompson.
Yep.
We've only ever seen the little, like, triangular dudes, but here we are with a whole new design that has some really interesting features that we'll see in issue two.
And as stakes are kind of ramping up in space and the crew is getting ready to get out of here, one of the red shirts actually sees something in the shadows. Kirk obviously is going to go check it out himself, and he finds hiding in the shadows not just a Tholian, but a Tholian child. You know, we realize that this other Tholian that they shot was perhaps a parental unit, perhaps a guardian. Regardless, we have a non-fully grown Tholian here left alone, and Kirk has no choice. This was a rescue mission, and this being needs rescuing.
Well, I mean, not to tell you your business, but I think he does have a choice, and that's what's interesting.
Fair enough.
Is that reasonably, Kirk has an opportunity here to say, okay, we're leaving. And instead, he chooses specifically to take this kid up. It's a dangerous call. It's a risky call. It's a it might even feel like a reckless call, which we'll get into in issue two.
Right.
Which a lot of are things that people sort of like rightfully or wrongfully attribute to Kirk. But what I think this really is a call made out of responsibility and guilt. He's just killed this Tholian. He's starting to realize, like, oh my gosh, maybe that was this one's parent or this one's guardian.
Yeah.
And now I have a responsibility to this child. There's also something else going on in Kirk. This is a really hard decision for him to make. And in issue two, we're going to actually essay exactly why he's making the decision he is. That he sees something of himself in this Tholian child, even though they are so very different and alien. And that's going to be a thing that we really get into pretty quickly here. I want to call this out just because this is a sort of interesting formal decision. Starting three pages before the end, we bring in the personal log, not of James T. Kirk, Captain. We've already seen Captain Kirk.
Captain Kirk's from later log on in the world. was the first page.
And we have future Captain Kirk on the first page. We have Captain Kirk's current captain's log on page four or six. And then here, we're actually getting the future log of Captain Kirk, or of Admiral James T. Kirk, who is here reflecting on this decision that he knew that he had to make and that was a difficult decision to make, and talking about all of the people who died as a result of that deal, all of the things that have happened because of what he does here. This is the unknown tragedy of Star Trek Year 5. What is it about this decision that leads to the way that Kirk talks about this moment here? How will it not just lead to that moment on the bridge that we see on page one, but actually to the sort of regretful tone that we're going to see out of Admiral Kirk there later on? And I think that's a really interesting thing. How could saving this child end up being such a dramatic decision? But it will. It's going to set the stage for the whole rest of the book.
Indeed. And with that, issue one concludes. And now we flip over to issue two, which if you're listening to this on Wednesday, hopefully you have in your hot little hand right now.
Yeah, it is out in the world. It's gorgeous. It's got that great Tholian web cover. It is really fascinating. Oh, and by the way, you should look and see if you can find the variants on these books. We'll take a little intermission to talk about the variants because they're insane. The cover of Star Trek Year 5 number one is a Greg Hildebrandt painting, which is completely insane, done for this book. Greg Hildebrandt, if you don't know his work, you actually do think about that Star Wars poster that you've seen copied everywhere with, you know, Luke with his lightsaber. That's Greg Hildebrandt.
Beefy Luke, yeah.
Greg Hildebrandt is the one of the most respected and iconic poster artists of all time. And the idea that he would take on, he'd never drawn Star Trek ever before. So the idea that he would take it on now in his 80s and bring this amazing cover to life is fantastic. I think this cover just sold for $16,000 at auction.
That was my fun fact. Yeah. which is why I am $16,000 poorer now.
Oh, yeah. That's where all your money went.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
All right. But we also have these great covers by J.J. Lendl.
Yeah, and every one of those covers is going to be basically the first issue of the two-part episode is going to be the first episode is the episode poster, basically. It's
correct.
Like a poster for the episode done in this really cool retro kind of style that's just really makes it pop. And then the second issue is always going to have a kind of a travel poster to the grand location that we're visiting. So they're all going to go back to back, and we're going to end up with 24 super amazing, awesome, basically poster size covers for that, which is going to be really cool. And then every one of these issues has like cast is going to have, you know, cast and crew alternates and all sorts of crazy stuff. Like IDW is not skimping on rad variants. So, you know, keep your eyes out and collect them all.
So we are now moving over to issue two, which brings us, boom, right? Like we're skipping ahead just a few moments. Kirk is on the bridge of the Enterprise. He is dealing with the natural ramifications of what has just happened, which is a Tholian commander is laying down the law. Whoop. What was that?
Ghosts.
Oh, nice. A Tholian commander is laying down the law. We get this great sort of rundown of what has happened in the previous issue.
Mm-hmm.
But from the Tholian perspective.
Yeah, which is essentially that, like, they've shown up a place that they were not invited to. They've crossed enemy lines and they've kidnapped a citizen.
And killed another.
And killed another.
And they're like, you gotta hand us back that citizen. But and Kirk tries to make peace on it. Tries to explain that he's not responsible, that he thinks maybe something happened to the Tholians below, that he thinks it might have been Tholians who did it. He's not sure. But before he can even explain any of that, the Tholians power up a weapon and speak in the only language that they think Kirk will understand.
War.
And so we get the first indication of this Tholian weapon.
And this Tholian weapon basically slices through the Enterprise like butter. Now, it does not, similar to how a neutron bomb actually works, it ignores all of the mechanical aspects of the Enterprise and cuts right through, and it deatomizes essentially a few poor people in the ship, and with this really gruesome kind of awesome pink and orange experience.
And a couple of pages before, we'd been warned that people were going to die because of this decision, and yep. Boom, there they are.
We are nothing but, if not, men of our word.
And unfortunately, it's not all mechanical. Most of the mechanical stuff gets ignored, but the computer core does not.
Yeah,
the Enterprise's computer core is down. But the question of why it affects the computer core and not the rest of the people on the ship is going to become a core question.
Right. It's a strange weapon. It is not a normal phaser. It's not something they would expect. And this is going to be kind of the mystery that the crew gets to riddle out while Kirk is dealing with the emotional mystery of what the fuck are we supposed to do next?
So Kirk is forced to retreat, which is a very un-Kirk action. They push back out, heading back for the as far as they can from anything else. They need to get away from there. They need to, not be getting attacked by this weapon that they have no defense for, or the Enterprise will soon be in pieces. Kirk's fundamental concern is always for his ship and his crew, at cost of himself, at cost of everything else. His ship and his crew are the most important thing to James T. Kirk at any given time. And so this was a really opportunity to say, okay, Kirk never runs. It's like, oh, he absolutely runs if it's between that and the ship and his crew being destroyed. And here he, delegates command to Scotty, which a lot of people forget. Like, we're so used to Sulu in that chair because he eventually gets command. But it was actually Scotty who was next in line if Kirk and Spock were off the bridge, which they are now, because Kirk and Spock are going into a conference room with Bones to have the most text of Star Trek conversations.
Yeah, right. Like, you cannot, as a professional storyteller, you cannot get away from the Bones-Kirk-Spock triumvirate, right? Like, these three, the ego, the superego, and the id, like, they are the perfect representation of what you want in your adventuring hero. And that's actually by design. Roddenberry, at the very start of running Trek, was like, well, I can't just have a perfect man as my captain, because who the heck is he going to talk to, right? So he takes the three personalities that he would need, the kind of the logic, the empathy, and the command, and split them into these three characters. Like, by design, these three are meant to contrast and conflict and riddle out every mystery, and only through that process find the truth. I wouldn't say that this was like a dream come true, but it was absolutely a dream come true
to get
to write this freaking amazing scene.
They are so fundamentally each other's balance, that when you put three of them in the room, they do the talking for you. You don't really write these characters so much as you channel them, because they really do fundamentally, they just work.
Yeah.
Spock always has Spock's position. Bones always has Bones' position. And Kirk is always sitting there at the decision point. What makes this scene interesting to me is that it's not simply them riddling out a question. Mm-hmm. Kirk has made a decision that Spock disagrees with, and that Bones disagrees with. That both Spock looks at this and goes, you are acting rashly. You have kidnapped a child. And Bones is going, it really doesn't matter what Tholians are doing to Tholians. We should not be interfering with this. Mm-hmm. But Kirk is looking at it and saying, guys, I think not only did the Tholians do this to their own people, not only was this some manner of either genocide or weapons test or something on their own people, but I think it's the very Tholians who were firing on us who did this. So I'm absolutely not giving this child back to them, because that would be equivalent to me giving up an innocent for slaughter, and I can't do that. But even after that, Bones and Spock look at him and say, honestly, like, I know emotionally that's how you feel, but logically you're putting the whole crew and this whole mission and all of our homecomings, because we're all heading home soon, in jeopardy just by the nature of your assumptions about this thing. You're putting humanity on this Tholian child, and you don't know what that Tholian child's thinking. You can't talk to it. You have no idea what it's thinking. How can you make these decisions? And that kind of question, philosophical question, is to me the heart of a good Star Trek show.
Yeah.
It's sitting there and saying, is Kirk's faith in this child going to be rewarded? And do we trust Kirk with this decision? Do we think that he's making the right call or the wrong call? And I think we want to be questioning that out at this stage in the issue.
And I think it's important also that, like, Kirk is not so unilateral and not so confident that he's able to look at his two best friends and say, you know what, you guys, you are wrong and I am right.
Oh, we kind of have this, filled with self-doubt.
Yeah, we have this wonderfully pensive last panel where clearly what Kirk is, or what Spock is telling him, is getting through. And when we catch up with Kirk, he's going to be essaying that doubt. Meanwhile, on the bridge, we get to write the most wonderful thing, which is a bridge crew without Kirk or Spock.
This was really your idea. I remember you sort of pitching me this idea. So you want to, like, sort of talk this out? I thought this was very, very cool.
Yeah, sure. I mean, like, so the idea is, I mean, well, loosely at least, this entire crew, sans their computer, can essentially work as their own, you know, their own brain. This is a room full of geniuses. Essentially, they are the best at what they do, and they can riddle out any problem, which is kind of what Uhura is actually the one to spark the conversation in. She prompts Scotty to start to, as we kind of point out, like, hack the problem, not technically, but socially, right? To utilize the resources available as the entire crew essentially puts their heads together and starts to riddle out this mystery of what is this weapon and what are we going to do about it?
Callback, by the way, to another piece of, you know, relatively well-known at this point Star Trek lore because of Star Trek 09 incorporating the Kobayashi Maru, but the Kobayashi Maru, which everyone knows Kirk cheated his way out of. And we thought this might be a really fun opportunity to sort of reframe that idea of the no-win scenario. Mm-hmm. But actually, what I wanted to sort of compliment you on, because I think this is one of those things that when we were talking it out was very much the revelation for this scene, is that Kirk runs the bridge like a commander. He solicits facts and then makes decisions.
Sure.
Scotty runs the bridge like a professor. He's asking questions of each of his people and drawing out the answers and then throwing those questions to other experts and drawing out more answers and then throwing that question to the next person and drawing out answers. And we actually see the professor that Scotty can be underneath all of this. He's a really incredible mind surrounded by other incredible minds. We get to see how his command style actually differs from Kirk's, which I always thought was like a really neat – it's like a look at a – like we've seen the triumvirate, mm-hmm. and now we get to see how does the rest of the crew operate without that triumvirate.
Yeah, or how does the rest of the crew create their own triumvirates?
Yeah, because like, we rarely see this.
Yeah.
It is extremely rare that an episode of Star Trek or that a scene in Star Trek would only feature Scotty, Bones, Uhura, and Chekhov. Mm-hmm. Scotty, Chekhov, Sulu, and Uhura. Because ultimately, Star Trek really anchored itself fundamentally on Kirk, Spock, and Bones, the original mm-hmm. series. These characters as having all this agency, but by and large, they don't. They have really individual great moments throughout the series, but it's not like Sulu's really got a particularly contingent character.
No, not at all.
From moment to moment. It's not like Chekhov has a particularly contingent character from moment to moment. It's just that we put that on them because we see what eventually became in the movies and what's become in the mythos and how much we project the actors onto it.
And that's something that we are very conscious of as kind of the architects of this story, not just of these two, but of the entire thing going on. Like, we need to be always very aware that this is William Shatner's show with DeForest Kelly and Leonard Nimoy, right? Mm-hmm. The three of them are at the core of it, but Shatner's always going to get top billing. And we kind of approach that in our scripts. There's a little Bill Shatner on our shoulders that, like, steals lines from people and takes them for himself. But at the same time, we, the fans of Star Trek, hunger for Uhura to take control. Like, we lust for Sulu's, you know, dry wit and for Chekhov's plucky demeanor. Like, this is the stuff that we absolutely want to gobble up, but the show in reality doesn't really want to give it to us. So, you know, this was a kind of, we dipped our toe in it. We're getting to explore this a little bit. And then down the line, other future episodes of Trek are really going to start expanding on this and giving our crew even more of a chance to shine.
And I think this is a place where the writer's room really helps too, because then individual writers can come in and say, I really have an idea for Uhura and I want to lens in on Uhura. I really have an idea for Chekhov and I want to lens in on Chekhov. Another thing I want to point out before we head to this next scene is just that by doing this little bounce around with all of the characters, Scotty manages to figure out not only what the Tholian weapon is, that it's this, you know, that it's this absolute zero, essentially what Chekhov calls a stasis ray and Sulu calls a freeze ray, but essentially also realizes that they can convert
their phasers.
The Enterprise's phasers to that frequency and thus fight back against the Tholians, but also that this must have been the weapon that was used against the people on the planet, against those Tholians that we found at Absolute Zero. Mm-hmm. So essentially by doing all of this without being asked by Kirk, the rest of the crew confirms Kirk's suspicions and manages to be able to tell him, hey, we think you are right, at the very least, that these Tholians did this to each other. Now, that doesn't mean that there's still humanity in the Tholian that they're saving. That doesn't mean that Kirk is 100% right, but it means his hunch is right. So it gives him the chance to go in and interrogate that hunch against a more personal question.
So meanwhile, down in sickbay, Kirk asks to be left alone with the individual. Asks Nurse Chapel. Yeah, asks Nurse Chapel to give him some space. Hey, Nurse Chapel, what's up? Doing your job, so good. And Kirk sits down, and this the Tholian child has his back to him. It's kind of hunched in. We really don't know what its mind state is. And Kirk unveils to him the story of why he cares. And that's Kirk's, you know, tragic past. He himself grew up on a small colony on the backwoods of the Federation, and through the abuse of the people that he trusted, Governor
Kodos.
Kodos, thank mm-hmm. you so much.
No problem. I'm here for you.
Basically, through the abuse of that man, basically to help their society survive, air quotes, he wiped out 50% of the population of their entire little colony.
And yeah, Governor Thanos.
Yeah, Governor Thanos, exactly. Trek was there first. Yep. And that is the thing that Kirk fears is happening here, right? He sees in this kid himself, even though that they are vastly different species, do not perhaps even speak the same language, but different body temperatures. He knows that this kid might have witnessed this kind of tragedy. And, you know, if that's the case, Kirk, it's incredibly important that he's not acting unilaterally, right? Like, it is not his job to seize this individual's destiny, right? It's not, he can't commandeer the narrative just because he feels what's right. You know, it is the child's initiative and the child's choice to determine what happens here. It's the child's agency that Kirk cannot rob him of. So the point of this entire story is essentially to give him permission, to let him know, is this something that you want from us? Am I close at all?
Well, there's a beat at the very beginning of the issue where the Tholian commander essentially says to them, you've done this without our consent. You've come into our territory without our consent. You've wrecked our, you know, you've stolen one of ours without consent. You've put a device in the hyper giant without our consent. All of these things you've done without letting us know that you were doing them, and it's kind of set off this problem. And so here Kirk is doing the right thing, and for all intents and purposes, asking this child for his consent to save him. And Kirk is showing why he knows what it's like to be this kid. Worth pointing out, this is a callback to an early episode of Star Trek, the original series, where we learn, in fact, that yes, Kirk comes from a planet where 50% of the population was wiped out. It always stuck with me. I always thought it was just such an amazing piece of backstory, this deep tragedy in Captain Kirk's life that he has never been able to totally let go of. The episode is called Conscience of a King and involves him actually finding Kodos the Executioner and learning that the man deeply regrets what he did and has become, for all intents and purposes, an actor after the fashion. It's also really brilliantly essayed in David Goodman's autobiography of James T. Kirk, which I want to call out as one of our primary influences on this book. It's definitely been a thing that we've looked at to try to help feed in some real smart moments of Kirk. And then we get to this page, which I think is our only silent yep. page in the book. Might be our only silent page in the episode.
Yeah, I'm sure that's probably true. And it's essentially Kirk asking for something as simple as a sign. And he rests his hand against the force field, you know, doesn't know what he expects. And the Tholian child essentially slowly turns around and then presses his forehead against Kirk's hand.
And Kirk knows in that moment that he does have permission, that this kid is, that this kid knows, that this kid has been betrayed by the people that he trusted, that he has been betrayed by his own people, and that he's giving Kirk permission to save him. And with that, Kirk is back into action, understanding what he's doing, and he is going to solve this damn issue. Mm-hmm. And here's where I think we do something that's a little unexpected. And I imagine there are going to be people who get to this point in the story and go, oh, huh? Which is that, well, just because the rest of the crew has spent all this time figuring out how to modify the phasers. And Kirk comes onto the stage and says, okay, what do you got? And they're like, we can modify the phasers to fight back and kill those Tholians. And Kirk says, no, we're not going to fight back. That's not the point. We aren't trying to get in a shooting war with the Tholians. If I can avoid loss of life, both on my ship and on the Tholian ship, I will. I don't care what they've done. I just want to make sure that this kid gets out safe and that the rest of my ship gets home. And so in this moment of measured understanding, Spock, who has spent the whole issue up until now questioning whether or not in going, you know, right at the problem, Kirk has maybe led them into a blunder, sees the man that he knows and that he respects and says, okay, you know what? I actually have a different plan that can utilize everything that we've learned, but not as a way of going into a shooting war, but instead utilizes everything from the very, very beginning of the book from the Einstein-Rosen Ouroboros device all the way to how we understand these weapons to work, to the Tholian language, to the situation. Every part of this mystery that's been designed, Spock has a way to put it all together and hands it to Kirk now that he knows that Kirk can be trusted with it.
And I genuinely love the idea that, like, Spock is a genius, obviously, but what he's waiting here, he's waiting essentially the entire back half of this issue to see what his best friend is going to do, right? He already voiced his concerns. He thinks Kirk is acting irrationally. He needs Kirk to think about these things. And then when Kirk shows up and says, no, I'm still the man that you respect, like, I'm putting human life, I'm putting life. All life first.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, we don't necessarily, because Kirk, I mean, Spock obviously doesn't show it on his face, but you know that his little Vulcan heart is like, all right, that's my dude.
Yep.
Right. And so they put together a plan. And I love the fact that, like, look, without the computers, that means we're going to need to rely on our crew. This job is going to need some fancy flying. Hey, Sulu, do you got it on lock? And Sulu's just like, absolutely.
Sulu's got it. I love this beat where he's like, he has to basically throw the Enterprise manually around a gravity well. And Chekhov tries to call him and is like, Sulu, the angle. And Sulu's just like, is exactly right. Like, Sulu's just got it. He's on point. He knows exactly what he's doing.
And that's something that we're going to do. We're going to be pushing for through the entire series. The show never was really quite sure what a Chekhov was or what a Sulu was. You know, obviously, the two characters weren't really supposed to interact. It was a casting issue. Takei was over off on another show, and so they brought in this young, hot, sexy, young Chekhov character, and then they ended up with both of them on set, and they were like, okay, I guess you're both the pilots? And it was never super clear. So one of the things that we are really going to be essaying and elaborating on is kind of the differentiated roles and perspectives of these two. Though we never really saw the tension in the show itself, any fan of Trek has to also understand, and anyone who's followed the kind of behind-the-scenes stories between the actors knows that there was a certain amount of friction between Walter and George. And we want to explore that. Like, there's a certain part of Sulu over time that's going to start sizzling, being like, well, the Enterprise doesn't need two pilots. Right? And that's something that he's going to be kind of exploring and essaying as we kind of find these two at odds.
Yeah, I'd argue that what we're doing has nothing to do with two pilots and is going to be a lot more personal when we get there.
That's very true.
Than that. But we can't talk about that without spoiling what's coming down the pike.
Yeah. So he slams on those antimatter thrusters. You know, they basically hit the J-brake and they come shooting around this gravity well. Perfect pause until they come to a screeching stop, putting the Einstein-Rosen Ouroboros, this massive gravity well device that we set up in our very first issue, basically between them and the Tholian ship that drops out of warp. There's this massive kind of gravity situation between the two ships.
And what that does, now that they know how the device works, is it actually bends the light of that stasis beam around the gravity well, meaning that they cannot fire on the starship. What this does is it allows Kirk to deliver an ultimatum safely. It allows him to say, look, we know what you did. we know that this kid is essentially a we know that you guys are war criminals and that this kid is, for all intents and purposes, a refugee. We are going to take the kid and we are going to give him sanctuary. He has asylum now from the United Federation of Planets, and there's nothing you can do about it. So please turn around and go away and we will leave and nobody needs to die. And Kirk says, let's go, and gets the Enterprise out of there in a moment of extreme sort of command and heroism. Here is a moment he has essentially played chess with these Tholians, and he has gotten them exactly where he needs to get them in order to make sure that no one dies. But he is betting on the Tholians not following him.
Yeah, and he turns, I think it's important, they turn the ship around. Essentially, he's showing it's not confidence, but it's, there's a bit of hope, right? He hopes that the Tholians are going to do the right thing.
And not pursue.
So they turn the ship around, the ship takes off, and unfortunately those Tholians cannot let it go.
Cool moment here where we see for the first time in Star Trek canon the inside of a Tholian bridge. And this was a really cool idea, I think, because something that we're going to be playing with more and more is that Tholians have a really different biological process than humans or humanoids or standard Star Trek aliens. They don't need to breathe. They generate their own heat. So a Tholian can exist in the vacuum of space. A Tholian can exist fine in the vacuum of space. So the idea that their ships, for all intents and purposes, aren't about keeping them from space. They're just about giving them capability at going out into space.
Yeah, there's no need for an atmosphere.
Means that now in this bridge, there's no atmosphere. And the Tholians can communicate in a way that doesn't involve air. So there's a whole different system going on here. And we get to see inside this bridge and realize, like, oh, no, these Tholians, they really do function differently than we do. And that's, again, going to be – that's a tease for stuff that's coming up down the line.
Yep. They're taking off. Unfortunately, the Tholians do not have quite the same piloting precision as our good friends, Chekov and Sulu. And that Tholian ship essentially zips past the massive gravity well, catches it on the corner, and is absolutely shredded to shit.
I mean, look, page 1819 is just gorgeous work. If what we really wanted to show here was, how devastating the gravity well is on the Tholian vessel, how by making this mistake, the Tholians kind of doom themselves. And I just think, like, what a wonderful way of doing that, and just beautiful DPS. And at the same time, giant shout out to Steven, who continues to do wonderful work, and to Charlie, who continues to make that work come to life. But here we also get our last of our captain's logs. Star Trek is relatively famous for ending its stories on morals, especially original series. Kind of the whole point was to end these things with a certain amount of wrap up. We're back on the bridge. Well, that sure was an interesting thing that we went through. I guess the moral of the story was this, and then maybe there's like a quip, and that's the end of the story.
Yeah.
So what we wanted to do is do our version of that. But here, Kirk has made a big decision. He's made a decision that's going to have ramifications. We talked about how, you get to the end of an issue or an episode of Star Trek, and the next episode, there's no real continuity. Mm-hmm. Here, there is absolutely continuity. James T. Kirk has just added a Tholian to the crew of the Starship Enterprise. There is now a Tholian child in Sanctuary on the Enterprise. They're not dropping that kid off on the next starbase.
He will definitely be around in the next episode.
And the next. And that ongoing storyline of how this Tholian child integrates with the crew is something that we're going to be making really the backbone of Star Trek Year 5. And so here you have him essentially saying, like, that creates this opportunity, this potential opportunity for war. And that is very troublesome to somebody like Captain Kirk, who, as Colin pointed out, is a philosopher and is a student of the classics and is also an enlightened man of the 23rd century. And there's no part of that man that wants to see – or 20 – yeah, 23rd. And there's no man that – there's no part of that man that wants to see himself kick off a war. Star Trek too often leans, I think, on war stories. And what we wanted to do was find a way to tell a story with the potential for war without making it a cut and dry, war story, especially because we're playing with TOS, and Gene Roddenberry's feelings on that were that Star Trek should rarely, if ever, be a war story. So we really wanted to find a way to, like, okay, let's essay the dangers of war rather than necessarily war itself. And shout out to I don't know his name, unfortunately, but there's an author. When we were rereading The Odyssey heading into this book, there was a great foreword to the version of The Odyssey that the translator had made that I was reading. And he mentions that to the Greeks, you know, The Odyssey was, for all intents and purposes, or not The Odyssey, I'm sorry, The Iliad, mm-hmm. was their first sort of big historical moment. Like, before The Iliad, there's not a lot of written history or, like, understood history. And so to those Greeks, history began with a war. And I always thought, like, what a fascinating concept mm-hmm. that is, yep. that it would create – that would create like a warlike society. Whereas with Star Trek, by the time that we've gotten here, history actually really begins with a peace. It begins with the Vulcans and the humans getting together and deciding that they're going to do something better. And here you have Kirk saying, you know, well, history might have begun with a war, but it cannot end with one. But we know that he has taken the first step towards perhaps leading them into a war. So that's going to be the sort of first step along the way to that scene that we see in page one with Kirk all alone on the bridge with none of his friends around him and a gun to his head giving the very last captain's log of the Starship Enterprise. And we'll be taking you along that journey for the next 2 years.
And that is a Star Trek issue two. We are so glad that you guys joined us today. Do you have any wrap-up thoughts about the amazing privilege or honor that it is to
it is an amazing privilege and honor
touching one of the greatest stories that has ever been put to celluloid.
We are not, like, no joke, just giant Star Trek fans in our own lives. We spend a lot of time talking about Star Trek in a way that has nothing to do with business or work or writing at all. So the idea of getting a step into these shoes was really daunting and very scary. But at the same time, I think what's become very evident is that part of that fandom and part of that love for the material results in – I think we both had this experience, right, where we – once we started writing the book, we would look at each other and be like, this is actually really fun. This is really fun.
Yeah, it was nerve-wracking to step into it. But then once it started, it's like, these are the characters that we've been living with our entire lives in a lot of ways. Like, these are the characters that we have modeled ourselves after as, you know, young men trying to be the best versions of ourselves. It is Star Trek. So the chance to play in this universe, I hope that you guys, the readers, and the fans – feel our passion and love. If there's one thing that I want you to be walking away from this book, it's like everyone here cares so much. And we are going to be telling the absolute, the apex story possible.
We're doing our best.
We are going to do our goddamn best. We are going to be riddling the entire series with both callbacks to stuff in the original series and also, I mean, secret, spoilers. So, like, keep your eyes open for all of that great stuff.
And brand new material. There's going to be brand new aliens. There's going to be a really exciting sort of pivot about halfway through, so about a year from now. There's going to be a really exciting pivot into new kinds of stories. I can't wait to get into what that's going to be.
Yeah, if you enjoyed these first two issues, we are not slowing down from here. Everyone else is going to absolutely bring the thunder. And this series is going to constantly surprise and delight you. So thank you so much for reading it. I hope you add it to your pull list.
And yeah, come back in a month, not obviously to here, but, like, you know, to the comic book shop. Come back here every week. But come back to your comic shop next month for issue three, in which case Brandon Easton comes in to take over on an issue that is all that is taking us all the way back to a planet that was left with maybe not Kirk's best solution ever, Sigma Iosha three.
And so, we'll find out if Kirk and the Enterprise can finally get
a piece of the action.
All right, Jackson, where can they find you?
You can find me on Twitter at Jackson Lansing. You can find me on Instagram at Found in the Wild. You can find me on Comixology and read all of my comics that I write with Colin Kelly. Colin mm-hmm. Kelly, where can they find you?
They can find me on Twitter at CP Kelly. There are a lot of great Colin Kellys in the universe, but I'm the only at CP Kelly. Don't look for me on Instagram. I don't use that. Buy my comics on Comixology. I'll just give Jackson 50% of what we sell. So he's, you know, pretty good guy.
Nice.
And And maybe like I'll see you on the street sometime and we can give each other a high five.
Yeah, we'll do that. And if you want to, if you like, we're like, wow, those guys really seem to love Star Trek. Maybe I want to like listen to more of their Star Trek. You should go. You have two things that I would really recommend you check out. One is on YouTube. Just go ahead and search My Spock and hear me do a rap all about Spock. I'm just saying it's out there. It's weird. I did it many years ago before ever working on this IP was a twinkle in my eye. If you really want my what Eisner Award winner or Eisner nominated comics creator Mags Visaggio calls the most insightful take on Spock around, check out My Spock. And then if you want other cool space adventures, go find Vast, which was a web series that Colin and I did a while back that with a bunch of our friends where we played a role-playing game that had a lot of similarities to Star Trek. So with that said,
yep,
this was amazing. Thanks again to everyone at Forever Dog for having us here. This was a blast. And yeah, we will see you all soon. Live long and prosper.
Forever Dog.
This has been a Forever Dog production. Executive produced by Dog. Brett Boehm, Joe Cilio, and Alex Ramsey. For more original podcasts, please visit foreverdogpodcasts.com and subscribe to our shows on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Keep up with the latest Forever Dog news by following us on Twitter and Instagram @ForeverDogTeam and liking our page on Facebook.